You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Well, as you may have noticed, we've got a new intro, as I am delighted to announce that Mysteries and Monsters is now part of the Straight Up Strange network. I'd like to thank Irene, Chris, Stephen and Mark, amongst others, over at the Paranormal UK Radio Network for their continued support and guidance over the last 12 months, and I wish them all the best for the future. I'm excited to be part of the Straight Up Strange network, and I hope you are too. I'm also delighted to announce that I've now got a producer for the show, the one and only Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. So as always, it's a massive thank for Brennan's continued support and guidance in the world of podcasting. Thank you, my man. And my last update for this week is that our first Patreon episode featuring Addie Lloyd from Monsters Among Us has also launched. So if you want to be part of the action, win exclusive merchandise, and get a guaranteed 2 bonus episodes a month, you can check us out over on patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters for just $4 a month. What other reason do you need? Right, that's enough of the updates, I think, for this week. So let's talk about the show. I'm delighted to be joined by authors and investigators Gary Cunningham and Rob Corns to discuss their brilliant new book, Irish Aquatic Monsters, A Survey and Definitive Guide. It's a comprehensive survey of the whole of Ireland and the historic documentation of reports of monsters, as well as an overview of the folklore of the Emerald Isle as well. We look at numerous cases of monsters, including horse eels, long-necked pinnipeds, and the infamous Duvacu, along with a look back at some of the forgotten cryptozoological trailblazers from Ireland. I think the book is a must-have for anybody who's interested into lake monsters or cryptozoology, and the link to get yourself a copy of the book will be in this week's show notes through Amazon. Don't forget, you can always find and keep up to date with everything going on with the show through our social media platforms on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and also Patreon is now live. And all our previous episodes can be found via Podbean at podbean.com, Mysteries and Monsters. Now, let's join Gary and Rob on the hunt for some Irish aquatic monsters. Gentlemen, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we today?
Yeah, not too bad, mate.
Yeah, good, thank you. Yeah, no bother.
Oh, now, what a fantastic book. I've read it twice now. It's one of those books that it's one of those that really is a definitive guide to Irish lake monsters and the aquatic beasts that live in and around this wonderful area. So what was your driving force between pulling this together? Because it's such a comprehensive collection of myth, legend, and modern sightings. It's a real work.
And I think we both had a long term interest in the sort of rich mythology and tradition folklore from Ireland. We both looked at it in different ways, and then when we crossed over, if you like, crossed paths and decided to try and investigate it a bit more fully and basically put everything in one place so that you had a go-to guide if you were interested in anything Irish.
Yeah, because there was nothing actually, a lot of the stuff that had been written before, Paul had been sort of, for want of a better word, plagiarized, and there was stuff, you know, had been regurgitated, and through our own research, and I'd been researching this for a long time, I would say about 25 years, with all sort of earnest, that we found a lot of stuff was wrong, and it had been misinterpreted, and had been, you know, details been taken down wrong. So, I say we got together about 2010, 2011, and we've conducted several expeditions, research trips into the west of Ireland, and particularly Connemara in the western part of County Galway.
I mean, it's it is fascinating to me because obviously as someone that loves anything to do with creatures of in the water, I think this is the kind of book for me that's the standard for what's required, really, because it's just so extensive. There seems to have been no stone left unturned by either of you in regards to the research and the expeditions and the research that's gone on just to pull this wonderful book together.
Well, thanks for that. I mean, one of the things we've learned over the years is that, you know, the people who've seen it have seen something unusual, have seen something that they cannot explain. So it's not really a question of making something up or hoaxing. You know, these honest people who've actually seen something, but they just cannot put it in the context of, you know, what it could be. And so, you know, what we wanted to do was just to, you know, really, really look at this in depth and try and work out, you know, whether there was something unexplained, whether it was a combination of unexplained and explainable, etc. Just to be as thorough as possible, because I think these days with cryptozoology, you have to take that approach. You know, if you want cryptozoology to be much more widely recognised and respected, you have to start doing the nuts and bolts, really looking at all the information and working your way through it.
Yeah, and I think as well, too, the two of the main aspects of cryptozoology in that, you know, field research and extensive research through archives and books and resources have we've married those well together, and hence, you know, we've had the definitive guide, which it definitely would be, because I mean, I, you know, as I say, I've been fascinated with this for a long time in this subject, because I'm from Ireland, and as I say, like, it's since I was about four or five, and you know, it's just great that it's been published.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that because you've obviously built on a foundation that seems to have been kind of left or put to one side, because there's a lot of work that was obviously done by Lionel Leslie and Holiday in regards to collating these original stories and experiences. So for you two, was it a case of, because for me, I think, I mean, I've heard of both of these gentlemen, but they don't seem to get anywhere near the credit that they deserve in this modern era. So do you kind of think that they've been forgotten largely?
Yeah, well, I think they have. I think they, it's because they went off on a bit of a tangent, and I think they both were influenced by the sort of whims and the fashion and the, you know, the beliefs at the time. So through the 60s and 70s and possibly into the 80s, so, you know, they went off at a tangent talking about, you know, the wider sort of ancient mysteries and ancient peoples and trying to link all those, you know, the modern settings with UFOs and an ancient sort of a cult, an ancient sort of race of people, as in when you read Holiday as a Dragon on the Disc, which is quite prevalent. But the only thing is that when I first got a copy of the Dragon on the Disc, I was delighted that there were about 30 pages which solely dealt with their expeditions to the west of Ireland, and that was important. And then I decided to follow up. I think it was a phone call actually from, well, sorry, I made to Dr. Carl Schuker, and also it was Peter Costello, who had obviously written the, you know, the seminal work In Search of Lake Monsters, that you know, I met him one time, and I was a phone call, a couple of phone calls, probably many, as Carl would say, that I made, and I said, like, you know, any other sort of information about it, and both said to me, look, there's an unpublished manuscript that Lionel Leslie had written but couldn't get it published back in the 80s. So then I decided to pursue it, and I just went to the Leslie, you know, to their main sort of household, their big estate in County Monaghan, and I just was persistent, and Rob will tell you, that's what, you know, anybody knows that's what I'm like, I don't give up too easy, and I just persisted, and I got through the good auspices of Lionel's great nephew, a man called Tarka Leslie, and lo and behold, it was one day just provided this very eccentric, just this big giant plastic bag, and in it were two copies of Lionel's unpublished manuscript on Irish and Scottish Lake Monsters, which is entitled The Water Horse, and lots of photographs, and even other stuff from other books that he had written. So it just was fascinating. But I mean, that is something, a future project which we will publish. We've still some work to do to bring it a bit more up to date. But I say that's, you know, so those two men did become a wee bit forgotten. And the good thing over here was I was involved in a documentary back in 2005, and there was a film producer, his own production company in from Dublin, Brian Redden, nice guy, and he unearthed a lot of footage from the RTE archives. You know, and I don't know if anybody's seen it. There's bits and pieces on YouTube, but it's just it's fascinating, and it's just very, a bit laughable as well, but it shows you the eccentricity and the, you know, the times when those two men were researching with the rest of the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau.
Yeah, as you said, wandering around with lumps of gelignite in your pocket, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And planks of wood. empty petrol tins with stones in them, which were called the special monster rousers, as Lionel Leslie put them. Called them.
Oh, and it turned into a boat, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The amphibious, amphibious car. There's still people in. There's still people in Clifton. We have a good friend, Brendan Scannell. Brendan O'Scannell, and Brendan remembers seeing the amphibious boat parked up, and it caused such a stir in Clifton. You know, you can imagine the west of Ireland, and you know, in the 1960s, like, and seeing this amphibious car, and I don't know what, it didn't really serve any purpose, and we've seen the footage, and Ivor Newby, who sadly deceased, was one of the divers on the Loch Ness team, and he just drove it into several of the lakes, and the wipers are going, and waves splashing up around the front, and then back out again. So, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting subject that, like I say, until you guys have basically shone a new light on it, it just seems to have been put to one side, because I'm often surprised how few people are aware of Peter Costello's book, which I read about 3 years ago. And I know it's a bit odd, because Peter hadn't really dove into cryptozoology at all, because that book's really not what he was known for at all, is it?
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's written extensively on, you know, people like, I think it's Keats, isn't it?
And James Joyce and...
Yeah. I read that when I was 13, and that just sort of stuck in my head, especially the idea of a long-necked pinniped, which obviously I've written about extensively as well. But I mean, I don't, you know, I was under the impression that pretty much everybody had read it, but obviously not.
Yeah,
I think the problem has been that within the Irish phenomenon, that it hasn't achieved the same notoriety as Loch Ness, because it has been in fits and starts. It's been quite a jumbled and a staggered sort of a topic. So you have had, you know, the writer that I remember the most wasn't Peter Costello, and it wasn't Ted Hawley. It was actually Graham McEwan. And I picked that book up and read it, you know, cover to cover many a time, and I was only 15, because it was published in 86, and that really fascinated me. But then after the 80s, then, you know, there was nothing really in Peter's book. There was nothing until I had collaborated, co-authored a book called The Mystery Animals of Ireland with a good friend of mine, Ronan Coughlin, which was published in 2010. And then, you know, was pretty soon after that, that through a strange quirk of fate, that myself and Rob got together. So, and here we are. So we are trying to keep it in the public eye. And as I say, we just keep on going, try and go each year, at least every second year, do more research, and we always find out more stuff and uncover new reports and unreported sightings, you know.
Do you think there's a lot of cultural issues with this as well? Because I think there is a tradition, especially when you talk about some of the older expeditions and things like that, that do you think that the locals were a little bit reticent in coming forwards with these weird people wandering around asking them strange questions?
I'd say there's definitely an element, you know, of that, and I'm sure there are many reports that we've never heard of and never will, because, you know, people aren't going to sort of talk about it to anybody outside their community. And certainly with the northwest of Ireland, Mayo, Connemara, etc., I mean, there is a very strong sense of community. You know, with sort of values that, you know, should be respected, but it does isolate, perhaps, people a little bit. And that area of Ireland is actually the sort of biggest area of Irish speakers as well. So there's obviously a lot more sort of historic tradition and folklore, which has probably become embedded in that as well, which, you know, might make people think twice as well about saying, oh, I've heard about a water horse, you know, to somebody, you know, outside their community.
I think as well, it takes a long time to, and we have done it. You know, I had done it a long time before. Rob was fortunate enough just to, well, just I'm very forward and not very shy. And it's about building up a rapport with people and building up trust, as Rob says. And there are a lot of reports that are embedded within the, you know, the local folklore. And even, I would say as well, to a lot of the, you know, the Irish traditions, you know, in Irish Gaelic. And I think, but it's building up the rapport, which we have done. You know, we've been about four times to Connemara and once to Mayo, and I've done it for a long time as well. So we've good friends now. We've established good friendships, and those people are trusted. And we have got reports from basically that they've rang us, you know, out of the blue. And it's not something that, you know, if somebody was very sceptical to say, look, oh, sure, that's easy. They're just sort of appeasing you, but they're not, because they've been very few and far between, unfortunately. You know, I mean, the last one that we're aware of is, you know, was 2015, and before that was 2012. So whether or not that's an indication of just people not seeing, you know, these animals are not being around the lochs and the boglands, or it's a case, or it's something that could be with regard to the creature's sort of behaviour, you know, that's sort of their lifestyle, which means that there's a gap of several years. So, you know, but unfortunately as well, too, the downside of it all is that a lot of the older generation in Connemara who would be more attuned to local folklore and stories, not essentially, you know, it's just the fact that it's just what their tradition, and that they unfortunately start to pass away. And if they're not, if those stories aren't collected and recorded, then you know, obviously there's a piece of history there, oral history, that which disappears and is lost.
Yeah, I mean, go on, Rob. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the things that we utilised quite a bit of in the book were the National Folklore Collection in Ireland, and especially the schools collection. Mm-hmm. And this was a survey done in the late 1930s where teachers asked the school children to write down all the local towns' customs, so everything, you know, from fairies to monsters, etc. And this was in pretty much all of Ireland, most parts of Ireland. And if you go into it and look at some of the reports, you know, and the records, you know, there's this huge body of belief, or sort of second-hand stories, or I knew somebody who told me that this had happened around lake monsters and everything, you know, water horses. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. I mean, Ireland's one of those countries that seems intrinsically linked with myth, legend, and folklore. So I suppose one of the hardest parts of this wonderful collection, I suppose, from my outside view, is dismantling what's an actual physical witness account and what's simply an old tale that's been regurgitated and manipulated as time's gone on. Did you find that a difficult aspect of trying to sieve out what was real and what was folklore?
I think, yeah, I mean, exceptionally difficult. I mean, what you have to remember is that although we hear a lot about Celtic culture, the Celts never actually left a written record of their beliefs, what everything they believed in meant. That was all transcribed, you know, from the 8th to 10th, 9th centuries by Christian scholars, who obviously pushed a new religion. So what they would have put their own little twist on, you know, perhaps a traditional story. Plus the fact that when you deal with entities such as the water horse, whether it's throughout Celtic and Scandinavia, it's clear that there's a sort of common origin, but getting to that point of origin is, you know, very difficult to interpret, and folklore scholars haven't really got the answers either. All we seem to know is that at one time, or maybe at varying times over invasion, migration, etc., the various sort of motives that were common throughout Celt, Burma and Scandinavia sort of probably combined into separate stories about entities such as the Water Horse, which would have then broken into slightly different legends as time went on. It was a mammoth job. And the other thing is, what we tried to do was actually pinpoint the actual lakes and locations, because a lot of the written record had been sort of interpreted by orally. Yeah. So there's sort of variations in names and lakes that didn't exist, etc. So that was very time consuming, trying to scour and identify, you know, the exact location.
We even found that, the modern term, which is always mentioned all the works before ourselves, would be horse eel. And there's confusion over that, and we couldn't find any reference to it before the Loch Ness Investigation Bureau came over in the 60s conducting their expeditions. So, you know, that was a bit strange. But then there's also, had to take into fact even the pronunciation of words and phrases. And, you know, I mean, you know, it just so happens that the grey seal in is known in Canada. Certain parts of it is known as a horse-headed seal. Mm. And even you're referring to, you listen to somebody who says, look, you know, a horse seal and horse eel, it's very hard to differentiate that. But we were surprised about that. I mean, I was very surprised about it. But we also, you know, I feel we work very well together as well, because Rob's knowledge is second to none. It's unsurpassed when it comes to the extensive research and going through, you know, the National Folklore Commission's records and all that archive material and newspaper accounts, whereas I might be more akin to, you know, I'm the sort of agent that would run across to a loch and would try and capture one of these animals without thinking too much.
With a pocket full of gelignite, yeah.
Yeah, a pocket full of gelignite, yeah. So we have, it's just, you know, we work very well together. It's great, you know, we're not the same, but when we come to do this, I mean, it's fantastic. We love it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, for an outsider like me, like I say, I've not seen as much in regards to Irish aquatic beasts as perhaps I should do. So for someone like me, gents, the only real creature I'm aware of is the Duvacu. Now, that's a legend that I believe goes back about 350 years with these mystic giant king otters that were extremely ferocious and would cause the locals a lot of problems. So do you think that's one of those traditions that's continued? Because obviously that's probably the most extensively known, I would suspect.
Yeah, it's definitely be quite famous, and it also helps that there's actually a gravestone from the most famous account of Grace Connolly.
Yeah.
And her husband and his brother, you know, chasing the Duvacu, which was said to have killed his wife Grace when she was washing clothes or bathing at the loch. So I mean, it's that's why it is, I suppose, well known, because the articles that have been written, you know, there's some sort of tangible proof in that you can see, and still to this day you can go and see the gravestone, which is quite small, by the way, and it's insignificant until you actually find it. I mean, it lies flat. It's not, you know, standing up. It's, you know, and whenever I went there first and started to investigate that, which was 20 years ago, there used to be a sign at the side of the road, which I have photographs of, but the sign's gone now, and it did say the Duvacu tomb. You know, obviously the last bit of the sign was missing. So there was a rich oral tradition there locally in Round County Leitrim, and also, you know, Donegal. But I think that we, and Rob will tell you as well, that a lot of it is folklore, which, when we start to investigate it, there's aspects of the natural history of the Irish otter, whether or not be some unusual aspects like the, you know, the colour of its coat, or even some sort of unnatural, unusual variations in patterns, or its size, particularly, you know, so as in giantism and really, really extra large specimens of otters. But it's well known probably because it's, I suppose it's quite sort of tantalizing and sort of a bit sort of fantastic, you know, where there's this giant otter running about the wilds of Ireland. You know, when you look at otters and you think, well, they're cute and cuddly and endearing and they're gorgeous, see them running about in the zoo or playing in the river. But, you know, as myself and Rob found out as well, I mean, there's an account of a zookeeper in Sao Paulo in Brazil, and he apparently was attacked by two Brazilian giant river otters who seen him as a threat because they thought that he was a threat to their young, and they attacked him and mauled him, and eventually the poor guy died. So you know, they can be quite vicious and quite sharp teeth, so you know.
Absolutely. I think otters are one of those creatures, as we've mentioned, gents, that to the average person, I think they just perceive them to be lovely, cute creatures, but they are ferocious carnivores that will have your fingers off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as in the book, there are sort of anecdotal reports not only of otters reaching about 7 foot, you know, found in the UK and Ireland, but there are accounts of them, you know, being very vicious. Mm. In fact, echoing some of the actual story in the first place. So, you know, there are reports of people being attacked by otters, or otters behaving in a very strange way. There's even an account of somebody being chased by an otter, and then the partner otter, or, you know, juvenile or another family member, actually came to the assistance of the first otter, which is slightly in keeping with the whole double coup story. So I think it's, you know, it may well be based on some sort of account where there was some sort of slightly homicidal, bigger than average killer otter on the loose, or, you know, vicious, more vicious than normal. But it only seems to really stem from that one, possibly two accounts, and the rest, you know, is something that's built up over the years.
Yeah.
And going back to the Irish Folklore Archives, again, if you type in double coup, you will see about 20, 30 variations of exactly the same story. So it's quite a well widespread story.
I have photographs of two different specimens of otters. One was a good friend of mine when I used to live outside Newry, and he had said, well, obviously it was a tradition then, and he, you know, went out and they shot a lot of things, and he had shot a bitch otter at a local lake, a local lock, and he said it was the largest one ever, and his spaniel dog couldn't lift it in his mouth. Wow. And it was a female otter, and I photographed it when I measured it across, and the width of the across just behind where the neck would be was approximately, I think, as close to 10 inches, and I think the otter itself, he said, it was obviously heavier. You know, it certainly would be over 30 pounds, or maybe even 40. Mm. Now, I measured it. It's stuffed, and, you know, measured the stuffed specimen, but it's faded. Unfortunately, the true colour of its coat is faded just through, you know, the fact that it was through sunlight, through UV exposure. But it's about 4 feet in length. But there's a larger one that resides in the National Park in Connemara, in a place called Letterfrack. And, you know, we've both been lucky enough to see it. Let's say our good friend Brendan O'Scannell works in the National Park. Myself and my wife saw it one time, and I didn't have a measuring tape, as you do, but it's possibly close to 5 feet in length, and anything over four for a normal Eurasian otter, and even the Arso species, is pretty large. It's pretty exceptional, you know. As I say, like before, obviously the giant Brazilian river otters were overhunted. There are reports of those reaching as long as 8 feet in length, and so it might even reach 6 feet. So it could be quite formidable, okay, you know. So I think there is, as Rob says, there's quite a basis of fact with regard to the Dover Coup legend, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that it's simply a case of giganticism appearing in, which occasionally happens across the world in a variety of animal species, that, you know, there's a genetic quirk somewhere along the lines where something gets a lot larger than it normally does. And we all, you know, and as you've touched on, gents, you know, otters around the world do grow to exceptional sizes, which would, you know, put the willies up somebody from the UK coming across one.
Yeah.
Well, I think you just have to accept that every now and again there will be an animal that is going to be bigger than the normal average for the species. You know, it just happens.
Yeah, within any given population, I mean, even our own, species of humans, like they're exceptionally tall people, and through a genetic quirk or whatever. So, I would say that it definitely has been based on fact, and even the likes of the white coat of the legendary Dover Coo with the black cross on its back. I mean, there are reports of otters, of albino otters, and still. There's that very famous one where a lady had photographed the albino otter up in the sky a few years back in the Western Isles. So it definitely does happen. The black cross in the back, there are albino otters with black spots seen. Even the unusual one in County Cavan, which we feature in the book, where it was brown with white speckles on it. It does. That's certainly, and it also has a... it brings on to another interesting point, in that one of the most famous sightings in Connemara, one of the 11 eyewitnesses when I last spoke to him did say to me, he says, "Gary, I do think that the animal we had seen back in the 60s, and it was a family of seven of them, he thought it was he watched a nature documentary about South America and thought that the animal they had seen was very close to, the giant Brazilian river otters. So it's interesting too, Luke.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that a non-native species has been kept illegally or used for other means and essentially just been dumped, gentlemen. So, we have that in the UK with that weird population of capybaras that lives in Norfolk. So, and I've stumbled across a weird alien population in Italy once. So, nothing surprises me in the slightest. So, and I've always found it odd as well that, other than Ireland, that the only kind of cultural legendary otter type creature I've ever come across before is all the way over in Alaska, which the Inuits have a legend of a creature called a Kushtaka, which is a giant sort of hybrid man otter. So it's very interesting that Ireland seems to be a real hotbed for these kind of stories and legends of otters with magical powers or abnormally sized.
Yeah, it's known in the Dover Coo, it's a very similar animal of legends known in Scotland as well. In the Western Isles, there's a lake, like on the Isle of Skye, called Loch Dovercan. So it has been known, so I think it's certainly to do with, I think it's linked to the a local population, for want of a better phrase, country folk that, people live in the country that would be more attuned to their natural environment, which we've found as well, But, that's only obviously one, as we touched on the book, that's only one sort of identity of one type of mystery animal, that has been seen in Ireland.
Yeah. I think the other aspect to all this is as well is that, history is littered with people that have come forward after seeing strange and unusual creatures in bodies of water. And they've essentially been made to feel like they're the stupidest person in the world. Do you think that's had a lot to do with this kind of reticence to come forward about it? Or do you think that once you've gained the confidence of people and the culture and the community, they seem to be more willing to open up about it?
Well, I think probably the biggest problem when it comes to that has been the whole effect that Loch Ness has had, since the 1930s. I mean, ever since 1933, 1934, anything that you couldn't necessarily identify in a body of water suddenly became a prehistoric reptile. And, you basically laughed out, even for thinking such a thing. So, I think whereas if that hadn't happened, if somebody had seen something, then, there's more chance that somebody say, okay, well, that's interesting. Let's go and have a look and investigate and try and work out what it is, not just say, oh, it must have been another plesiosaur, on holiday or something.
And there are other identities, when we have, I say one of the most fascinating identity for the animals and seen in a lot of the lochs in Ireland, and particularly Connemara, would be an undiscovered form of pinniped, the family that includes seals and sea lions and walrus. We've explored that in a previous work as well, but I say that's one of the main goals, is hoping to try and see one of these animals, that one of these pinnipeds that shouldn't be there. And Rob will expand upon, the fascinating tales of, you were talking about out-of-place animals, Paul, and Rob will tell you even better about the reports of the sea lions, which is fascinating in itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one of the probably most unexpected findings of our previous work, which was that in the UK and Europe, where you don't have a population of indigenous sea lions, over the years, you've probably had, at least a dozen, probably two or three dozen, have escaped or been deliberately released from captivity, certainly prior to the First and Second World War. Now, people think of pinnipeds, they think of seals, and in Europe and UK we have got several species of seal and some vagrant seals, but they're all true seals. They've all got that sort of torpedo shape, they're pretty helpless on land, whereas sea lions are sort of morphologically completely different. They're much sleeker, maybe even reptilian looking, especially if you see them coming out of the water. They can use their hind flippers, so they can gallop along at quite fast speed. They can climb obstacles. They get around, basically. And if you were driving, past a lock in the middle of the night, think of Arthur Grant or the Spicers, and you suddenly saw a wet sea lion just bound across the road, bearing in mind that it could be 8 foot long and standing 5 foot high. You may well think you've just seen a prehistoric reptile. When actually it's an escaped sea lion. And I think that's a bit of a game changer when it comes to lake monsters in Europe and the UK. And, it would never surprise me that many of these accounts are simply due to these animals straying up rivers and getting into lakes. And because they're not an indigenous species and they can look much more different, people tend to have perhaps mistaken them. And if that happened in 1933 at Loch Ness, that would explain why all the land sightings suddenly stopped in 1934. Then there could have been something there. It caused a bit of confusion, and then it just went away again. And unlike a 30-foot plesiosaur, which you'd probably have a fair view of if you tried to keep wandering up and down back to the sea, a sea lion, an 8-foot sea lion, you're not going to probably see it.
Yeah, and I would say as well too that when you look into the modern reports, so say post 1930 odd in Ireland, and one of our strong points, personally speaking, would be Connemara, and I'd say there's different aspects of those unidentified animals which you can fit into the framework of the identity of an eared seal. As in an otara, as in a sea lion, or a northern fur seal. So, for example, whenever eyewitnesses have spoken about the animal was seen rolling about on the edge of the loch shore, on the edge of the bulrushes, that can be attributed to, which it has happened, that can be attributed to, the method of pinnipeds sloughing their skin, where they want to remove the dead, agitated skin, which is, obviously terribly itchy. So you have that. You have even the famous, my most memorable and favourite sighting would be the coin sighting in Loch Narrowan in 1968. Whenever you talk to them and they tell you about the description of that animal with the two stumps or horns and the open mouth and the curiosity towards the family dog and the speed and flexibility of the animal's shape and the speed and flexibility, the movement of it in the water, even the fact that it got into the loch in the first place, which isn't right beside the sea, which is the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, it has to traverse over land and up, negotiating tiny streams. They're not always necessarily big, rain-swollen rivers. So there's that. There's also, I suppose, you have the fact that they are able to migrate over land. a scene from Lake to Lake, or Loch to Loch in Ireland, sorry, that would fit that identity, plus also the longevity of them. I mean, you know, if you take into consideration, it could be, you know, could live for 30 or 40 years in the wild, that, as Rob mentioned, those escapees, particularly in the 1960s when the flurry of sightings happened, even all the way down from County Mayo, Donegal, Mayo, and Connemara, and to a certain extent into Kerry, which is, you know, coincidentally enough, it happens to be the Atlantic seaboard of Ireland, that, you know, those escapees could be responsible for those classic sightings and those very famous sightings, which were investigated, which was the reason why the Loch Ness team came over in the first place.
Plus,
we know that some of the accounts in the book can be attributed to indigenous pinnipeds, like the grey seal, which can get very big. It can get into lochs, where it may be quite surprising when you don't normally consider it to be a sort of land animal, if you like. And if that can cause confusion, then add a much sleeker version, which is much more mobile and maybe slightly longer neck reach. And, you know, people are going to get confused.
Yeah.
You know what? Yeah, sorry, I have photographs in the our guide, in our book, that was a great photograph, and it just looks like the classic upturned boat, and it's of a grey seal. There were a number of them off one of the islands off Connemara called Inishbofin, and I just happened to take lots of photographs, and one of them just showed the grey seal diving under the surface of the sea, and it just shows the classic humped upturned boat shape, which actually has been reported in Connemara from Loch Shannaheaver, which is one of a chain of three lochs, which have had, you know, a lot of notable sightings by a good friend of ours, Tom Joyce.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, strangely enough, the other day I saw some footage of someone was putting up saying, what would you say if you saw this happen? And it was essentially footage of an elephant seal vertically breaking the surface of the water by about a foot, 2 foot, and having a look around. And it's one of those things, I think, if you're not sure, like you guys have said, if it's happening in a body of water that you're not expecting to see something like that, straight away, I don't think people think, oh, well, that's a seal. They think, what the hell is that?
Exactly. And if there's a strong sort of element of folklore around that lock or that area, then you're just going to associate it with that. So the story lingers on, if you like. It moves forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those subjects as well that I think for anybody who looks at it with a sceptical view, gentlemen, they will always point out that, you know, everybody that sees anything, as I'm sure you've come across during your research for this book, is completely mistaken, doesn't understand what they're seeing, despite the fact that these people might be, you know, people that have fished for 50 years and or worked at sea or know the area and the locality and the nature around them. I've always been baffled why we dismiss experienced people who see strange things out of hand. And it's always, oh, well, it must be a giant pike or a sturgeon or an eel. And yet you come across a lot of these kind of reports where it can't possibly be that, because it's not behaving in the way we know these creatures do.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the times it may well be down to something like that happening, but, you know, sometimes there won't be a straightforward explanation, which, you know, to me makes things a bit more fascinating. You know, rather than jump to the conclusion that there is a prehistoric reptile here, which has just caused that sighting, you know, think about other potential possibilities. You know, take an in-depth look. You know, you can't just create animals, you know, monsters for the sake of creating them, basically. And the classic, as I said, is the whole escapee sea lion thing. You know, I mean, that's never been taken into account before. But that could be quite a big game changer when it comes to European or UK lake monsters.
Yeah.
I think there's also a... it's important also to mention that a lot of the, until you actually visit the west of Ireland, a lot of the lochs which have had the modern settings, particularly Connemara, I mean, because that would be our, you know, we've researched there extensively, And that's why I keep going back to it. Plus, it's also been the area which has had the most modern sightings. But those lochs are relatively small in comparison to the, you know, the giant lakes of Canada, you know, the monster hunted lakes of Canada, like Okanagan and that, or Champlain in America, or Loch Ness and Loch Morar in Scotland. So they are smaller. So an eyewitness can, you know, even though it's slightly difficult to judge distance over water without any actual framework, if you want to, you know, see it from that sort of skeptical point of view, in that they still can recognize something. So if it is unidentified, it's unidentified because they can't actually know it, they don't actually know what it is. And I would still say that if you did see a sea lion, particularly, you know, as far back in the 60s and even further than that, in a freshwater loch, you certainly wouldn't expect to, not only not to see it, but you wouldn't really know what it is. And if, you know, folklore has influenced you, you know, well enough from your family or, you know, your neighbours or that, you would put a different sort of slant on it. And, you know, I don't mean that in a negative sort of way. I just mean that it is what it is. Like, you know, you just wouldn't recognise it as such. But whenever we started to investigate it, you know, you do, when you talk to the living eyewitnesses of those, you know, so to speak, classic sightings, for want of a better phrase, that they do start talking about, they don't say it's a seal or a sea lion, but they do start to describe features which are very pinniped-like. You know, a head, they say, like, oh, the head was like a Labrador.
Yeah.
You know, as I said before, you know, as previously mentioned, the two horns or stumps, you know, the open pale mouth, the black, you know, the black texture of skin like an eel, the four stumpy legs. So, you know.
Yeah, and plus, you know, let's not forget that animals like otters, sea lions, seals, they will, I mean, I think a lot of people seem to not be aware of that these creatures will travel over land to get to different bodies of water. Eels are one of those creatures which I think a lot of people are not aware that if they need to go somewhere, they'll go.
Yeah.
You know, again, there's anecdotal reports of eels or freshwater eels that are two or three times the size they should be.
Mm.
So they're monsters in their own right. They're not huge 30-foot, you know, really, you know, obvious monsters. But, you know, you saw a 9-10-foot eel, you know, you'd get a bit of a shock, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, and as we said, you know, every now and then this happens. You'll get a big otter, you'll get maybe an extra large eel. And, you know, even other things, because one of the accounts in the book, which we sort of stumbled across a possible answer, seemed to indicate that either a Cuvier's beaked whale or a Risso's dolphin was actually swimming up a river, getting into one lock and then another lock, which is, you know, sort of really unheard of, but it happened to explain the report we came across.
Yeah, like we just came across that. I had known about the sighting and spoke to Rob about it. And the local gentleman, Phil Mortimer, had told me, he said, look, I seen a water horse, and my mother had often spoke about them, and I seen it, it was white, and, you know, his description and his, I drew a sketch based on his account, was in the guide in the book, and it, it's, you know, he said it was white, and it was rising up against the waves and moving across from one side of the loch to the other. And when we started investigating that, I think it was 2015 maybe, I think that trip, and we just went down to, there was a wee cove down, which is up from one of Ireland's three fjords called Killary Harbour, and there's a small place, another wee sort of inlet, which is called Little Killary, and I just happened to get out, as you do, look, and I started talking to a local man there, and I just said, look, do you know anything about the reports, just as you do, like, you start talking about lake monsters, and it was very, very helpful, and didn't try and hit me or anything, and we spoke for a while, and he said, by the way, he says, you talk about the likes of a possible whale, he says there's a beluga whale was washed up in this wee cove only a couple of years previously, and I said, God, I'd never heard about it, I'd never come across any reports. He said, well, you wouldn't have, because it was all very clandestine, and Galway County Council came and disposed of it literally overnight, and it wasn't then, something clicked, and I went, God. We both said, you know, that could have been a beluga whale that from Phil Mortimer's sketch.
yeah.
from his description that would have made his way, you know, up in after salmon and sea trout.
Yeah.
And into Loch Muck.
Yeah.
And then eventually into Loch Fee. And Loch Fee is quite deep. You know, they've done sonar soundings and part of that loch, which is all, you know, a big glacial system, drops to 150 feet in depth.
Yeah, I mean, belugas are incredibly intelligent as well, because I think most people have seen that recent footage of that one being caught near Norway with a collar on.
Yeah, that's right.
That had essentially been part of a secret Russian espionage program and enjoyed playing fetch.
Oh, yeah, they had that, yeah. They had a whole fleet of, well, not a whole armada of animals. Spies, yeah.
So...
trained to kill.
I mean, it's,
but there's even footage. Sorry, Paul. There's even footage of a beluga, which is the first ever footage recorded around our shores, and it was off County Antrim, near the Giant's Causeway, and I think it's still on YouTube, as far as I remember. And it's certainly a beluga whale, and the local man just there was a guy there visiting, and just saw this thing, you know, off the coast, and started filming. And it's a beluga whale, and the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group started hemming and hawing over it and looking at identifications and identifying features and thought, rest of it was dolphin. And, but it wasn't. It's a beluga whale. For all the world to see, you can see it. So, you know, there are several records of beluga whales. So it's just the fact that, you know, not everything is a monster per se, but they are certainly, there are unidentified animals. And it's the fact that Ireland has quite a unique position in the Atlantic, whereby, you know, Arctic species have come down, you know, through being pursued of a main group, as in young male walruses, or looking for new, you know, as in new territories or even new food sources. You know, you have ringed seals, you have bearded seal, hooded seal as well, and obviously, quite famously, you have killer whales as well, not just the population from the Outer Hebrides, but you've also the ones joining them from Iceland, so... North Atlantic, so that's why it's important to, you know, to note as well that Ireland has a quite unique geographical position in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. I think, did I see some footage recently of some whale sharks being seen off the coast of Ireland?
I don't know about whale sharks. There were two killer whales, which were part of the Outer Hebrides group. They were seen only about 2 weeks ago. You know, but they were, they're well known, they're identified. But it just, they are part of that the Outer Hebrides group. But it's just that it's, and we came across a piece of footage by accident as well on YouTube, and it shows you a man walking on Achill Island, which is Ireland's largest island. It's off County Mayo, and it's connected to the mainland by a bridge. And we have investigated there as well back in 2016. And there's a piece of footage, and it shows the, you know, it's just a couple, man and woman, and they're going down. It's to an isolated beach. It's called Anna Strand. And a fantastic place. I've never went down to it, but I will. And it's, you know, you're looking across the Atlantic. You're on the west, one of the westernmost parts of Ireland, and they just scan across the beach. And there's this animal, and it's white and black, but it's headless. And you only see it for a couple of seconds. And I said to Rob, I said, oh, Rob, what is that? That's, you can see from a size point of view, you can see, you know, in one part of the frame, you can see his walking boot. Yeah. And then you know it's not a bird, like a seagull or anything. And I went, Rob, that actually looks like the same size, albeit minus a head, of a ringed seal. And we both agree that's what it is. So that was just washed up, you know, on an isolated beach. So, you know, God knows what else has been washed up. You know, we've come across accounts like that. You know, especially in Connemara as well. There's a local tale of a giant otter, which was washed up on Omi Island. You know, so it's just fascinating. It's just, it just keeps us enthralled. And, you know, unfortunately we can't go. We were planning to go actually next week, but obviously due to the present situation, we're unable to go, so we'll have to wait the next year. But
yeah, I mean, I've always found it peculiar. Now, you two clearly know a lot more about the aquatic patterns of animals, but I'm often astounded that people just seem really shocked when they see unusual creatures around the United Kingdom and Ireland, as if we don't live on islands. Do you know what I mean? It's unusual that people just seem to think, oh, well, we'll never see that. As though the sea perfectly, you know, the animals that live around the UK and Ireland, nothing else passes through or uses it as a breeding ground or a passage to different territories. It always baffles me to why people. It just seems like the general assumption is weird creatures don't live in the sea.
Yeah, and another, I think, as you sort of mentioned earlier, another finding when we're going through archives and stuff was the amount of non-indigenous animal species that have been reported, you know, in England and Ireland and around the coasts. You know, obviously escapees from menageries, etc., imported and then released. You know, and that's not just recent time. You know, that's going back 100 years or so.
Yeah.
So you could quite well have populations of animals that shouldn't really be anywhere around where we are.
Mm.
You know, out there somewhere.
Yeah.
I think one of the most exciting prospects for us in our research would be the possibility that there is a form of long-necked pinniped, which does reside in the North Atlantic, whether it's something that's totally novel to science or, say, an existing population or, you know, of northern fur seal or setter sea lion that has been able to make its way across the Northwest Passage due, obviously, to, you know, climate change and being relatively ice-free certain times of the year and has looked for an ecological niche which has been vacant for that sort of a predator, and which does make sense because, you know, there are, I know obviously fish stocks have been overfished. It's obviously, sadly, it's quite sort of infamous around Scotland and Iceland, but, you know, there are populations of sea lions, of those eared seals off the west coast of Africa, Namibia and that. So in the south, in the South Atlantic, but nothing in the North Atlantic. So that, to me, is quite exciting. And I've often sort of been quite frustrated with the fact that, you know, documentaries and, you know, natural history units don't, you know, with their vast budgets, don't try and investigate and do something worthwhile. And, you know, you have researchers embedded in. Like, I mean, you do see some amazing footage now that was never shown before, like polar bears hunting on, you know, Ellesmere Island or Svalbard, I think it's Ellesmere Island, hunting on the cliffs after the sea by the guillemots and that, and you know, 100, 200, I think it's about 1,000 feet up. So there's likes of that, and, you know, why, and they have vast budgets, you know, so why not sort of take a, you know, I suppose it's like looking for a needle in a haystack as well, but there are clues, like there's, you know, I mean, I say, you know, there are sightings in the west coast of Ireland, so, you know, but I say we're obviously restrained by the fact that we don't have that luxury of time or the expense, you know, with regard to the technology and able to embed down and stay there for a full year and through all the seasons to, you know, which would be wonderful, but we just can't do it.
Yeah, I suppose the other aspect of this as well, gents, is that a lot of animals, we're basically working on the principle of perhaps what we know over the last 100 years. And, you know, let's be brutally honest about this. Think creatures like seals and whales have been hunted for as long as we've been able to set sail.
Yeah.
Yet now most of these creatures are coming under new protection. Surely it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility that these creatures are simply going back or coming back to areas that they used to exist in 500-600 years ago, and they've got a genetic blueprint or a memory of an area, or it's a spawning ground or whatever, that still has that resonance for these creatures to start to return, knowing these days that they're safe.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. You know, I suspect as time goes on, you know, we'll probably come to understand that a bit more. I mean, our sort of speculation with regard to the whole sort of undescribed pinniped was potentially a fur seal or a fellow sea lion that had become separated from the sort of Pacific Northwest, had ended up somewhere in the North Atlantic, maybe Iceland or somewhere around there, had been in competition with existing pennipeds, and so had adapted to maybe swim up rivers, you know, into lakes to exploit new food resources. And one of the things that theoretically they could have developed would have been a slightly longer neck, because that would help catch spawning fish, etc. And if you've got, say, a northern thurtle or a stellar sea lion, which again, you know, could approach the size of a small horse, it can gallop over land to a certain extent, it's got a couple of ears and a mane, could you not have your origin of the warthog? You know, so it's all speculation. It's theoretically, you can build those sort of cases. But it would never surprise us to find that there was some species of first seal or sea lion in the North Atlantic that hasn't been documented, and we haven't found any paleontological evidence so far for.
Well, there's a good analogy there with regard to the vegan ecological niche, where you have grey whales now that have been sighted in the Atlantic and even in the Mediterranean. So after, you know, 300 years of the northern grey whale being hunted to extinction, and the whalers knew them as scrag whales, you know, off the coast of Newfoundland and off the that part of America and North America, that, that they are now, you know, there have been sightings. So and they have come back now. I haven't seen any more sort of information or reports. I remember reading about it. It was quite fascinating. So as Rob says, the other thing that to remember would be to look into the folklore, if we were able to do it. You know, there are sort of tantalizing sort of snippets of information with regard to other regions in the North Atlantic. So for example, you know, Greenland, Iceland, and those parts of Scandinavia like Norway. So, you know, I'd often theorize that, you know, before myself and Rob collaborated, that, you know, maybe a population, the reason why there are so, the sightings do happen sporadically. I mean, maybe there's a pattern to the sightings because maybe those animals migrate, you know, in a certain pattern around the North Atlantic, whether or not be with regard to food or whatever. And that's why they're only seen in so many different, you know, not all the time in, off Ireland. You know, it's an interesting point, you know, it's an interesting speculative point, like, so, you know, exercise and speculation, I suppose. You could do graphs and, you know, log the data in. But I say, just to also get back to the fact about unusual, or those, you know, the fact that a pinniped with a long neck or whatever, I mean, I think there's still now, there's fairly good evidence anecdotally that those animals responsible for over in the western part of Canada and Cabrasaurus would be vagrant elephant seals. So, you know, it doesn't surprise, as Rob says, like, it's a very important point to note about a water horse, like a stellar sea lion. And there's a famous clip which was going about on Facebook and that, of the two stellar sea lions on the yacht.
Yes.
And they are brutes. Like, I mean, and, you know, anybody wants to see the size of a stellar sea lion, a male stellar sea lion, go on to YouTube. There's ones in certain animal parks and zoos. It might be San Diego, I can't remember where it is. And gee, the size of a male stellar sea lion is very, 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 it's just unbelievable. It took your breath away. It's, and also the very famous one would be the sea lion that the Russian trawler accidentally catches in the net. Have you seen that?
Yes, incredible, that footage.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Where it just, just tosses the dog like it's nothing. And they try and hose it off the deck of their trawler. I mean, that's a beast. Like, I mean, I, you know.
Yeah.
But
there are some crazy bits of footage. I'm trying to think where it is. I think it might be in California. There's a very famous footage of an enormous sea lion that comes ashore and takes a shine to a car and basically tries mating with it. And it's almost as big as the car. It's incredible.
Yeah. Exactly. And the other thing, that one of the early findings of our research, you know, years ago, was the fact that actually the Brysons, which is a small island group, I think it's North Devon, actually had a stellar sea lion on there, which had been living there for 20, 30 years. Now, how on earth that animal became to be a resident, you know, nobody knows. But if that had been trawling around, you know, Ireland or the coast for 20, 30 years, you know, you may well have thought, you know, it could well explain a few strange encounters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, if that, penguins can turn up in Tasmania, nothing's beyond the realms of comprehension as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, pretty much so. It's fascinating that about that, you know, the Stellar Sea Lion was just accepted, or, you know, probably look at people going past going, there's a Stellar Sea Lion. But that has happened with regard to walrus in Ireland, mm-hmm. and there is a, I have a photograph, I must get it actually off, as a guy who runs wildlife tours down in West Cork, Paul Connaughton, and Paul sent me a photograph of a walrus, which was taken back, it's not that long ago, within the last 15 years, and it's in Ballinakil Bay, which is in Connemara, near Letterfrack. And there are also reports of, there was also a famous one where surfers and people driving past in County Mayo and Clew Bay have seen this large thing and just thought it was a rock. It turned out it was a walrus, which had been there for a few days. You know, so it does happen. And
yeah, surfers, man, yeah, you know,
yeah, I know, yeah. What's that? There's a big rock that's just moved. But I for us, you know, our dream is obviously to be at an isolated lock, and there are many in Connemara. I mean, you have to just look at not an ordinary road map or anything, but if you get into a detail in the ordnance survey maps of Ireland, you can see that Ireland is one of those countries in the world which has one of the highest frequencies of locks of fresh water, bodies of fresh water for its size. I mean, obviously, the greatest in the world would be, you know, you have Canada, I think it's followed by Russia and Finland, but Ireland would certainly be up there for its frequency, its number of locks compared to its size. I think there's well over, I remember reading somewhere before, and there's certainly well over 1,000, there's a few thousand in Ireland. Connemara alone has 300 to 400. The bogland that we actually, you know, one of the boglands in Connemara is called the Roundstone Bog Complex, has 122, I think it is, within 25 square miles. So, you know, there's lots of uninhabited wilderness still in Ireland. And the thing, the important thing to remember is that whenever, you know, a scientist or a biologist will come along and, you know, get down from their ivory tower and say, oh, no such things can exist in Ireland, in such a small body of water, it's not about the fact that they don't reside there, it's the fact that they do, as we touched on earlier, do migrate when the need arises, and have done over land from lock to lock, and it's also their close proximity to the open ocean, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I would not be surprised if there is a couple of undiscovered species of seal and pinniped in general. Because, you know, we only have to look at the variation in sharks, for example, to see that, you know, here is a species of creature that is essentially a shark, but you've got the gigantic ones, you know, such as whale sharks and megamouth sharks. But then we've also got, you've got creatures like hammerheads, you've obviously got the great white, you've got the blue, you've got tiger sharks, you've got bull sharks, which can have managed to evolve into such a way that they are equally comfortable in fresh and salt water. So why are we constantly boxing in known creatures, saying, nah, it can't be anything else, everybody must be seeing a log?
Yeah, and I think another interesting thing certainly is hybridization. There's certainly, when it comes to pinnipeds, you know, sea lions and fur seals, which have sort of produced offspring, which have been a mix of both, which is, you know, quite interesting. I think there's a lovely clip somewhere on the internet of this really ginger-looking hybrid fur seal. Which, you know, it's just got these huge blue eyes and it's all ginger. It sort of looks very weird and was ostracised, I believe, because of its appearance. But, you know, you could have all sorts of combinations, which, although they're supposed to be sterile, you may well get a few that may sort of persevere.
There's even the very exciting possibility, although I don't think it's actually very... It's not widely accepted anymore, but in Roy Michael's book, Searching for Hidden Animals, he talks about the legends of the Tesseract off Alaska, and, you know, indigenous people there and First Nation people that talk about this serpentine, very vicious, you know, sea monster with, you know, vicious teeth and snake-like head and that, and he often wondered, was that a northern equivalent to you know, a northern form of leopard seal? Mm-hmm. It's not really talked about anymore, but I used to think about that as well for a while, and although the reports don't really fit, the only thing that really fits, I suppose, from our perspective in Ireland would be the serpentine nature of it. But and the size, obviously, because, you know, leopard seals can grow up to 12 feet. Large females can reach that size. So, but I think the only downside of it is that the majority of the animals reported would be, you know, the black coloration, the forked tail. You know, it's even interesting to note that when we looked at, you know, because we have had access to Lionel Leslie's unpublished manuscript, and even which very kindly was provided to us by Dick Rayner, one of the main researchers at Loch Ness, which were the recordings, the tape recordings, the audio recordings from their from the Loch Ness people in Ireland when they did their research, and you know, you talk about the Coins animal, which is actually be known as one of the best and certainly most detailed lake monster sightings anywhere in the world, and it happened in Connemara. You know, a family of seven, the Coins, watched this animal for for 3 hours in February 1968, February 22nd, just got bored with it. And but Mrs. Coyne did mention that it's in the Lionel's unpublished work, and the tail was like a mattock, so in other words, you know, like a pickaxe. So that was never mentioned before, and it's often, you know, it's often sort of left out with the any sort of books that deal with lake monsters and then delve into Irish loch monsters, you know. So that forked tail, you know, the black coloration, you know, the ability to go over land, you know, the sightings of them on land, the four stumpy legs, you know, the longish neck, the open mouth, the, you know, the pale interior, the two stumpy horns, you know, small head, that all, you know, screams to me like it's a sea lion, you know, and certainly an unexpected sighting of one.
Absolutely. I think, like Rob touched on earlier, though, do you think this is more to do with certain people wanting everything to be a dinosaur, and therefore anything that doesn't fit this template, you know, such as we touched on earlier, that, you know, one of the first notable Loch Ness sightings, as we've spoken about it, if anything, sounds like a sea lion, if nothing else. Do you think it's that kind of trying to fit sightings into this predetermined bias of a plesiosaur that seems to wash over or ignore certain witnesses and sightings such as that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've only got to look at, you know, social media or some websites and, you know, what some people have written. But thanks to Loch Ness, you know, any unexplained aquatic creature becomes, by default, some sort of plesiosaur or variant. Now, you know, I mean, we all grew up on that, but yes. I think, you know, you don't need to create those sort of animals. Just as enthralling, actually, trying to investigate in more depth what's going on. Now, that's not to say that some of the huge lakes, you know, in Canada, America, may not harbour some sort of cetacean or primitive whale or something slightly unusual. But I think when it comes to talking about lakes in Scotland and Ireland, given the fact that many of them, or most of them, are associated with some sort of folkloric entity which has been interpreted as being the forerunner of the monster, modern monster reports, and some of these places are like 200 yards across. We're not dealing with any sort of relict, prehistoric reptile, you know, or unknown animal. But there is, you know, some explanation behind it.
But then there's also the point as well that it's journalistic bias, and it doesn't doesn't provide, you know, really good front page news. So a sea lion spotted in an Irish loch, or a Scottish loch for that matter, it's not as exciting. Or the sell papers as well as a plesiosaur, an undiscovered remnant from the lost age of the dinosaurs. So, you know, that's also important to remember, and that's whereby that Loch Ness has had a detrimental effect. And the nice thing about Connemara and the west of Ireland is the fact that there isn't that sensationalism or overhyped tourism built up upon these sightings, you know, which is good as well, because it doesn't, it still retains a sort of its magic, you know, and there's still a sort of, you know, we can build up the trust of local people there. I mean, you know, I remember reading before that Steve Feltham took, you know, has taken probably the last 20 years to build up trust of local people there on the shores of Doris and Loch Ness, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's just one of those things because, and I'm amazed we've gone an hour and a few minutes without mentioning Jeremy Wade, but
yeah.
I mean, he's a prime example of someone who has gone to bodies of water all across the world and has found unusual or extremely large versions of known creatures that, to all intents and purposes, shouldn't be in the bodies of water that they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, sorry, Rob.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly, and I think, Gary, you know, the story about the that the specific species of...
pike?
Pike, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's different.
Yeah,
that's actually... What happened was, and it's touched on in one of Jeremy Wade's episodes of Dark Waters, in that there's one of the largest lochs in Ireland, in southern Ireland, is called Loch Derg. It's not to be confused with another Loch Derg, which is up in Donegal,
yes,
which is the site of a pilgrimage. But it's Loch Derg has had reports for a long time, going back, you know, 1920s and then 30s of giant fish or a giant unknown creature, which was all, for all intents and purposes, like a, you know, like a giant pike, which Ireland's very famous for, the same as Scotland and other regions in Northern Europe and America, and that, you know, so there were reports, you know, maybe even 70 feet in length of these giant pike, and pike weighing 80 pounds and maybe even more, and they were often dismissed as a classic fisherman's tale. But it wasn't until a couple of years back that Italian scientists actually uncovered evidence that Ireland, and only in that loch, in Loch Derg, there were indigenous pike which were different from the rest of the European pike found in Irish waters, in rivers and lakes, in lochs, and that they were giant, that they had the propensity that they'd reach massive sizes. But sadly, they've been overfished and may be extinct now. And I, through discussions with my brother-in-law, Seamus Bracken is an avid fisherman for the last, 40 years, and has caught pike as large as ever. It was 34 pounds and was 5 feet in length in County Monaghan. But he has said, look, the reason why they're extinct in Loch Derg is because the Irish Fisheries Board has netted them all and removed them all from the loch. They haven't been overfished, they've been deliberately netted, because in Ireland there's big business, particularly in the west of Ireland, in those waters, for other Europeans to game fish for salmon and sea trout and ordinary brown trout, and it's not seen as, pike, you know, giant pike will prey on other fish, particularly salmon and sea trout and trout, so that's why they've been taken out, which is an absolute disgrace. But he touched upon it, and then he went over to Scandinavia, I think to Sweden, to try and catch one of these unique separate species of pike, which he did do. So that has happened, and we uncovered a report 2 years ago. I was talking to a local man at one of the famous lochs, which is called Loch Fada, which in Irish just means long lake. So Fada means long. And I just happened to speak to him, and he was from Donegal, but had lived in Connemara for 40 years and was an avid member, an avid sort of a proponent of trying to protect the waters from overfishing of salmon and sea trout. Not to promote it for wealthy tourists and Europeans, but just to say, look, we need to protect the stocks. And he had said, look, I said, have you seen anything unusual? And he said, well, myself and my son, back, it was only, I think, the previous year, 2016 or 2017, had been fishing a loch, which is only briefly mentioned in John and Colin Board's book, Alien Animals. It's called Loch Nahillion. And they, you know, they only touch in the Gazette here of, and mention the loch, but no details of it. And he said, look, I actually saw it with my son. We were fishing. It was June. It was late on after 11 o'clock. And being the west of Ireland, the sun doesn't set till late. Mm. And it was a, you know, beautiful day. And they saw this giant fish come up to the surface. And it wasn't that far from shore from their sight. Mm. And he said, I said, what was it? He said, look, Gary, it's a giant ferox trout. And I said, what size are you talking about? He says, well, he says, half the length of my car. And he had an estate car. And he says, I said, what do you mean? He says, oh, about 7 feet. And easy over 50 pounds in weight. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so there are mysteries. And that's, we'd never heard of a report from there before. And again, it just shows that, that Ireland does still have, you know, it's not as, it's still important. But for us, obviously, the long-necked pinnipeds are the ones that they're the superstars for us, so we want to sort of get definitive proof that they exist.
Absolutely. And long may your searching continue, gentlemen, because it's...
Thank you.
This book is just... I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to find anything you've not included in it, to be honest. It's phenomenal, and I would suggest that anybody who has any interest in aquatic beasts should definitely pick up a copy. Because it's essential reading for any library and any cryptozoologist or anybody with an interest in cryptids or strange creatures. It's a must-have book, in my opinion. You should be both very proud of the work because it's fantastic.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
So, gentlemen, what's next? Anything on the horizon once we get out of lockdown?
Well, I mean, we're itching to go back to Connemara, but as Gary says, you know, it's probably not going to be till next year now.
Yeah.
I'm sort of working on ideas for maybe a volume of aquatic cryptozoology, so, you know, A's for whatever, and build up a whole set.
Yeah.
Also, we're looking at, you know, investigating, doing a sort of Scottish equivalent of the Irish book.
Mm.
But that would take a very long time.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. But I think as well, too, we'd like to sort of on our, you know, our YouTube channel and that, and just try and promote, you know, some video footage of the regions and the areas in Ireland that we investigate, because sadly there's nothing really there except, you know, the sort of footage from the 1960s of the Loch Ness team, which is sadly in which is obviously in black and white. Sorry.
We've got a couple of Facebook groups that anybody's welcome, you know, share any information. Or one is Rob and Gary's World of Aquatic Cryptozoology. The other is Irish Aquatic Monsters. But the other thing that, you know, again, we've sort of created as a sort of a spawn of the main book is, we know that not everybody, you know, is going to be into cryptozoology or into those sort of mysteries. But what we've done is we've broken down the book into separate little mini guides, so sort of field guides to each area in Ireland. So that if you're a tourist or you're on holiday, you know, hiking, camping, and you've got an interest in the folklore, then you've got a little guide that tells you where these sightings have been, etc.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we would hope is that, you know, people may come across new accounts or, you know, little tidbits of information that hasn't been there before, which we can then include and, you know, sort of get out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, I love, one of the little things I love about the little book is that on every little loch and body of water, you've got like little drawings of what's supposed to be there, which I think is fabulous. And like you say, it's not just about these creatures. There's a, you know, you touch on the folklore and the legends and saints and things like that. So it's a wonderful book, and it's available on Amazon, I believe, is it not, gents?
Yeah, and there's also Google coordinates, so for each you know, location. And there's actually a map on our Irish Aquatic Monsters Facebook group, which has got all those places. You can just Google and find the exact location.
But the wee symbols, just to say, are very nostalgic for myself, because the first book that got myself interested in the whole field of cryptozoology was published, I think, in 1977, in the Salesborne book of the World of the Unknown series.
Yeah.
And it's the one on monsters, and the section on after Loch Ness, talking about lake monsters worldwide, and it has two wee... you know, 2 wee drawings of, you know, many humped lake monster, and it says Pooka and Paste with arrows pointing to Ireland. And that got me hooked, and I was only 6 at the time, so it just shows you how long I've been, you know, something that was so influential, but I've been hooked on it ever since, and as I say, I've still got that book. It's great.
Absolutely. Well, I hope, as far as I'm aware, I think they are planning on republishing the rest of the collection, because obviously the Ghosts one came out last year, which was down to, which I think was down to somebody who worked at Usborne setting up setting up a petition.
Yes.
And it went a bit mad, because I know the 14 Times got hold of it, and it all went well. That sold over 9,000 copies after it got released.
Wow. That's fantastic.
So I don't understand, because, you know, like, you know, as both of you gents, I'm of the same era. You know, they were must-have books as a young man who loved weird things. So, you know, long may it continue. So, gentlemen, thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. The very best of luck with the book. It's absolutely fantastic, as I've said numerous times. thank you again. And you two, take care. And I will have to make a trip across the Irish Sea.
Oh, definitely, Look us up. We'll have to collaborate and get out to the wives of Connemara. But say thank you once again, Paul, for having us on, and been an absolute pleasure. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, gentlemen. Hey, no problems. You're very welcome. All right, you two take care.